Rock and roll is a game with many willing participants. From the outside, it's a no-brainer, an easy, fun vocation that reaps endless rewards. Upon a little closer inspection, though, one will find the game of rock and roll to be rigged from the get-go. It lures entrants by dazzling them with all the potential bounty to be had: the gold records, the beautiful people, the endless admirers, the bright marquees, the trinkets, the toys, etc., etc. But like a street hustler with a three-card Monty trick, once the bet's been placed, the con is put immediately into play, always turning the band into the scapegoat holding the bag at the end. And most will have little or no sympathy for them, chalking it up to their deserving comeuppance for daring to advance their station. And if a band is lucky enough to achieve a modicum of success, whether it be through some esteemed blog or through forceful major label duress, it is always fleeting. While we, as the audience, are privy to their glory, we never see the years of hard work that led to the band's moment in the spotlight, nor the anguish that overcomes them when the spotlight ultimately moves on to its next victim. We are complicit in the music industry's wanton need for the newest, the freshest, and the youngest. It's an industry resembling a factory conveyor belt, churning out product at a breakneck speed to appease some all-consuming beast with no time to actually step back and listen to its contents, no matter how revered and respected they might be. Once the fame train has moved on, as quick as it came, most bands quietly fold. They get day jobs, they lick their wounds, or steal the time away until their stock rises again for a quick nostalgic cash grab, much like water rising in a toilet tank after one flushes it. Music industry insiders have whittled the average lifespan for a name band to 7 years. That's not enough time to call it a career. For most, despite success, despite awards, despite how decorated a band can end up becoming, a lot of the time, being in a band ends up merely being a long, protracted hobby. And since the music industry relies on acts to have quick expiry dates, what honors are bestowed on bands who happen to last longer than the 7-year cutoff point? What accolades can be heaped on bands who have the tenacity, the doggedness, and the stubbornness to stay in the game? At what point do we start to recognize the real McCoys from the forgeries when, come hell or high water, limelight or not, these bands prove to anyone and everyone that they're in it for the long haul, to be given the chance to perform their music? Helix are a hard rock band from Kitchener, Ontario, Canada, and they've been around for over 40 years. In that time, they've managed to put out 13 studio albums, 3 live albums, 2 EPs, and released nearly 30 singles. They've toured the world, racked up gold records, platinum records, and most impressively, been able to outlast short-term fads and passing trends that ensnare and constrict most bands. Through it all, highs and lows, through success and tragedy, has been lead singer Brian Vollmer. He's been the constant in the world of Helix. He is Helix. And the chance to sit down with Brian was something I wasn't going to pass up once I was given a window. Still, this podcast took almost a year to have happen. We had discussed doing it while we were recording our last record, Fire Music. It was originally going to be me and Eric Ratz, our producer for Fire Music, sitting down with Brian. Eric knew, just as I did, that it would be a privilege to be able to sit down with the man and listen to what he had to say. For me, living in Toronto, it isn't easy to get to Brian. Brian lives in London, Ontario now, and his time away from the nucleus of the Canadian music industry that is Toronto has given him, over the years, almost mythic status. When he's spotted, whether he knows it or not, most in the know do a double take and ask, "Holy shit, is that the guy from Helix?" Well, when Brian Vollmer agrees to be on your podcast, he doesn't go to you. You go to him. This is earned respect. I won't move my smallest toe for most, but for Brian, I'll get in my car and do the 2.5-hour drive to London myself. There are hundreds of stories lobbed over by bands that are supposed to be interesting, but their trough is as shallow as an inflatable swimming pool. I want to hear the real stories, the stories from a time before we tweeted about it, 60 seconds after it happened. and I want to hear stories about people that have been deified, and I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. I want to talk to Brian Vollmer, and that's what I did. I spent the morning into the early afternoon one day with Brian, as you are about to hear. What you don't get to hear was the personal tour he gave me of his house dubbed Planet Helix. Once the podcast mics were turned off, it was a guided tour through the history of this legendary band through photographs, mementos, keepsakes, souvenirs, and awards. I was a kid in a candy store, and I can't thank Brian enough for that. I also want to thank Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for supporting the podcast. Thanks to Chino Loco's Restaurants for making fish burritos stuffed with chow mein noodles. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thanks for leaving a review if you have as well. Brian Vollmer of Helix is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn and Guinness, Danko's go out down low for free. I'm sad, but I like to sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing, hang down, down. What do you see in my future? What are you reading in bones? She paused for a while, flashing alligator smile, and she told me, Danko Jones.
I feel it's absolutely compulsory for you to listen to the Danko Jones podcast. Many times, Liz and I camped out in front of our Fisher 500 hi-fi receiver, hanging on Danko's every word. It's what we used for inspiration when we both starred in Under Milkwood. We even got Peter hooked by the end of the production. Peter O'Toole, that is. I implore you to go now and listen to Danko expound on subject matter most of us don't even think twice about. Listen to him turn anything into podcast gold. It's simply fantastic.
The Danko Jones podcast is simply superb, splendidly fine, wonderfully wild, very divine.
I'm at Planet Helix. I made it out. I did the drive. This is a big day for me.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It took me a few hours to get here. I've been wanting to do this for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about coming up here with our producer of our last record, Eric Ratz.
Yes.
While we were making our last record, we're like, you know what? Let's go to Brian's and let's just do this podcast and let's get these stories out of him and all this stuff. So, a lot of people know about Helix.
Yes.
From this one song that was a worldwide hit.
That's right.
A staple of rock music, which is Rock You.
That's right. And ironically, that wasn't the biggest hit of the band's career. It was Heavy Metal Up.
Right. Which was on the album previous to
Which was on the first EMI Capitol record, No Rush to the Wickeds. And it was a song we wrote about Joan Jett.
No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was about her.
Yes.
And did you have a run-in with her? What's the story behind that?
No, we just had her in Myron. We wrote the lyrics of the song. We thought, well, if we had a Heavy Metal Love, what would she look like? We thought she would look like Joan Jett, dressed in leather, swinging a guitar.
That's funny because with the popularity of Rock You, did they re-release Heavy Metal Love? Because I remember seeing Heavy Metal Love after Rock You was out. Was it just because of the whole the snowball of Rock You that they just...
No, it was because of the fact that when we released Heavy Metal Love in the United States, that was our first single in the U.S. in 1983. It was the first year for MTV, and the video for the song went to a heavy rotation. And we were pulling into places... for instance, we pulled into Washington, and we'd never been there before in our career, and there was a lineup a block long for the band, and I just went, wow. And it was the effect of TV was so incredible on our career at that time. And in Canada, they had released the Eddie Schwartz song, Does a Fool Ever Learn, which didn't really do too much on radio. When the second album came out, Walking the Razor's Edge, I think that the Canadian radio didn't want to be caught behind the eight ball, so they jumped on the song immediately. And in, and when Rock You came out in the United States, it started to become a hit, and then they fired everybody at Capital EMI. And by the time they got people back in the positions at the Tower, they had lost the song. But in Canada, because the song was a legitimate hit and had legs, it took off, and there was no looking back.
It's, you know, now it's just part of, what would you call it? It's just been ingratiated into the whole classic rock lexicon with all the classic songs. People know. But sometimes everybody knows the song because of the classic intro, the chorus. It's just so classic. Sometimes people don't remember the name of the band. And I've had to tell people, like, yeah, I'm going to go talk to Brian Vollmer.
Well, the biggest comment we get when people come to the show is they go, I didn't realize the band did that song, and I didn't realize it did that song. And
yeah,
you know, we've had quite a few hits over the years, and we continue to put out records. And on one hand, the song is a bit of a curse because, like you said, sometimes they know the song more than they know the band. But we do owe our career to the song, and I get nothing but good feelings towards Rock You and Bob Halligan, the guy that wrote it.
Well, take me back to when Walking on the Razor's Edge was taken off and Rock You was like zooming up the charts. How was your life? How did it was it an overnight thing? What changed?
Well, our career wasn't an overnight thing. We'd been together about, I think, 8 years by the time that song actually came out. But when the song came out, it was almost an overnight thing. We actually recorded a beer commercial for Labatt's based on the letters of the song. Instead of going, give me an R-O-C-K, it was give me a B-L-U-E. And by accident, the beer company actually put the commercial out before the album came out, and Capital was ready to take them to court to sue to get a brakes put on that commercial. And then Labatt's pulled the commercial, and we had to do another one with Heavy Metal Love. Instead of Heavy Metal Love, it was called Labatt's Blue, something like that. But I remember being down in New York City at the backstage at the Meadowlands. We had just played with Rush on the Grace Under Pressure tour, and they came backstage, and I still have it on my Super 8 film somewhere downstairs, but Barry Bergman was there, the manager of Bob Halligan, who wrote the song, and my manager, Bill Sipe, and the band, and they told us the album had gone gold in Canada, and somebody on the film jokingly says, yeah, in a couple of weeks we're going platinum, and everybody laughed, it was a big joke, and in a couple of weeks we did go platinum after that.
Right.
And in Canada we ended up backing up Triumph on the Power 7 tour or something like that, and
Their big album.
It was a big album for them, but it was funny because we were holding our own against Triumph at that time. So the song definitely had an incredible effect on our career, and it was very quick.
I can't imagine a band at the time with Helix, with Rock You, riding that crest, having Helix open up for them. I can't. That must be a nightmare for the headlining band.
We played with a lot of great acts back then. We did a whole tour of the United States with Whitesnake and Quiet Riot. Then after that tour was over, I think ICM, who was our booking agent at that time, farmed us out, and we did a couple tours with Heart. I know we played with Motorhead a couple tours, and great times.
I think it was when we were flying down to Miami to do the motorboat cruise last year, and we ran into you guys at the airport, and we just said, we dropped Motorhead's name, like we're going to play Motorhead, and then bam, you dropped some Lemmy stories immediately. Like, what were those? I can't remember them.
I remember quite a few things about that tour. First off, we started off touring the United States with actually Molly Hatch and Blackfoot, and that tour fell apart after a couple days.
Wow.
And ICM put us on the Another Perfect Day tour with Motorhead.
Right.
And we were all pretty green from the perspective that we'd never really been in the United States. We weren't really like a hardcore band like a Motorhead. So we were more like a jukebox band that toured the bars in Canada. So we were a little bit in shock, to tell you the truth, because here's Motorhead, you know, and everybody's loaded and drunk and stoned. And
Brian Robertson, right?
And Brian Robertson wanted to fight me in the middle of House of Guitars one day. And but Lenny and I got along great. And I remember going to do a radio interview one day with Lemmy, and the DJ wanted us to do anti-drug commercials, and I'm going, great, what's Lemmy going to say? And he didn't even flinch. He pulled the microphone up, and he went, hi, my name's Lemmy from Motorhead, and I want to tell all you kids that I'm going to do drugs or don't do drugs, because all my friends that done drugs are either dead or they're going to die, so don't do drugs, kids.
That's great.
And the first time I ever met Lemmy was actually in Rochester, New York. We were playing the Penny Arcade, and it was that same day that I nearly got in a fight with Robinson down at the House of Guitars. I remember they were carrying the gear, and he was passed out on the, behind the club, and they were carrying the gear right over top of his body. And we had gone down there to thank the House of Guitars, by the way, is a great big music store, and they sell guitars and records. I don't know if it's still there. But back then, it was a monster place, and everybody used to go there. And we went down to thank them for selling our first two indie albums, Breaking Loose and White Lace and Black Leather. And Motorhead was notoriously late for sound checks and in-stores and everything else. And that day was no exception. And when they showed up, Robinson had a 40-pounder of vodka, and he was pretty drunk. And I happened to make the mistake of saying, hey, Rob, I'm having a bad day. And he grabbed me by the throat. And, you know, started freaking out on me. And I thought he was going to hit me. And all these kids that were waiting for Motorhead to show up at the in-store, just everybody just got kind of quiet. And, you know, kind of like, is this part of the act? And but later on that day, we were back at the Penny Arcade. And I'm sitting there at the bar with beside Lemmy. And all of a sudden, he turned to me and goes, do you believe in God? And I went, yeah. Then he started going this big tirade about his father being a preacher and had lent him some money. And then he told me about being a roadie for Jimi Hendrix. And they did some windowpane acid and were stoned for 3 days. And how Hendrix had a tackle box, like a fishing tackle box full of different drugs. And it was something I'll never forget, that's for sure.
And what was that, first week on the tour or something?
Yeah, about that, yeah. But he was a great guy. He's a very intelligent guy, Lemmy. He's always reading. Pretty deaf, just like yours truly. I became a Motorhead fan big time after that tour. I think one thing about Lemmy is he's a genuine person. I love genuine people. I hate people that, you know, they're one person on stage, then they walk off and they get in their little, little car and they change their clothes and they're completely different people. What you see is what you get when you meet Lemmy.
Mm-hmm. It's fun. It's interesting listening to you say that you were thrown in this world of Motorhead because you guys were just basically a bar band from Canada.
Yeah.
And, you know, since people got to remember around this time, there wasn't the infrastructure that, you know, we have today for up-and-coming bands or the scenes. Like, there's a punk rock scene, an indie rock scene. You guys were doing it in the only scene that was available to you, these bars.
Yes.
Putting out two independent records before No Rest for the Wicked. And you were an independent band. A lot these days, independent bands are a genre unto itself, and given the distinction and credibility. But you guys were doing the exact same thing back when there was no infrastructure.
We were probably one of the first bands to ever put out their first album. And when we did it, everybody said, no, it's not going to work. You ain't going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to tour. And we proved them wrong. We took money from my grandmother, from my manager, from his mother, I think the first album cost us $26,000, and we recorded it at Springfield Sound just outside London here. Had actually a studio owned by Brian Ferryman, who now manages Michelle Wright. And that album became a hit in Texas with a DJ called Joe Anthony, who is known as the Godfather of Rock and Roll. He worked at Kiss KMac out of San Antonio. And he broke Moxie down there, Triumph, AC/DC, Judas Priest. He controlled that whole market in Texas. And Then we came out with the White Lace Black Leather album. That became a hit, number one import in England for us. And we actually used to sell them between sets, and we sold about 15,000 copies of each album, believe it or not, off stage. And that led to our being signed to Capitol Records. And we were one of the first bands, like I said, to ever release their first, release an independent album. We were, the first bands to do that.
People don't remember that time, how hard it is it's a dream back then to put out even to record your own song, to have it out. There mm-hmm. was no scene for that, especially if you're in a band. What I remember was like a cover band scene, like a heavy cover band scene.
That's right.
But original music on vinyl being sold out, that was, you guys were almost an anomaly back then.
Well, we started off, when we put original material into the set, we did one set, and we did it on an East Coast tour, I'll never forget. And it went over great. In fact, it was our best set of the night. Back then, you played 3 to 5 sets a night, usually 3 sets. And then we started going a little bit further, and we did 2 sets, and it was still great. And then we went completely original, and the band just did a nosedive, and we're having problems getting gigs. This was just previous to being signed to a Capitol EMI. But getting back to the circuit that you're talking about, I think it was actually a healthier breeding ground for bands, because you could play 6-7 nights a week. You could tour right across the country, and learning all those cover songs helped our writing. And it because I think when you're learning cover songs, you're really learning from the best people in the business. And that bleeds over into your own material. And being able to see the country, you know, going to, say, Brandon, Manitoba, and then going down Yonge Street in Toronto, and then you're in Vancouver, and then you're in Edmonton, makes you more well-rounded, not only as a performer, but as a person, gives you more of that world view of things. I find bands nowadays, they never get out of their home town, because there is no place to play during the week. So, you know, what do? You know, you can't go to Thunder Bay and sit there for 4 days twiddling your thumbs, because you still have to pay for rooms, gasoline, your road crew, and things like that. So I feel it's a real impediment, the fact there's no circuit out there anymore.
And it's really the classic way, going back to the Beatles, how they would just do covers mm-hmm. and covers and, like you said, multiple sets a night.
Well, it was even more with them, because they used to go, they'd play a set and then they'd go to a different club.
Right, right. And I think I agree with you that whole way of doing things and how to become a strong songwriter as well as a performer is lost. And that's why I think, you know, when I see bands, I'm a lot of the time unimpressed. There's nothing that really hits me from left field as much as it used to, I think. I want to go back to, because I'm really fascinated by the whole point of, for example, you were saying you're opening up for a lot of bands. Motorhead, yes. Triumph. Mm-hmm. You even mentioned Heart.
We did 3 or 4 tours with Heart back then.
How was that?
I don't remember too much of that, believe it or not. I don't know why. I never even met the band. Some of the guys
really?
Met the band. But
Nancy Wilson? No?
I remember playing. It was a different kind of audience, right? I don't know if I felt a little bit alienated by that or what, but I remember playing this one place, and it wasn't racquetball, but some Florida game they play with. I don't know.
Badminton?
No, it wasn't badminton. It was something else. They have these clubs down there where they play this certain game. I think it's like a thing where you throw a ball around, but it's like a scoop or something. I don't know. But Heart were great, sound-wise. But like I said, I didn't really get to meet them. I remember other bands more vividly. Like, I remember playing with Mitch Ryder, which I thought was...
Oh, wow.
A great thing, you know, actually being in the alley taking a squirt right before the show, and there's Mitch Ryder taking a leak right beside me. I remember playing with Alvin Lee from 10 years after at Painter's Mill in Baltimore. Also on the bill was Crack the Sky. I remember that very clearly. I remember playing with Meat Loaf at the Rainbow Theater in Denver. You know, gigs with Y&T in Texas.
Yeah. Okay. So this is you guys as an opening band, and you were saying when you were on tour with Triumph for Power 7, mm-hmm. you guys were almost co-headlining in a way in terms of audience popularity. When was the flip? Where did you start headlining with Walking on the Razor's Edge, or did you even on that album?
I'm trying to remember now exactly where it was. I think maybe at the tail end of that tour we started to do headline shows in Canada. It wasn't until the next tour we actually headlined over in Europe. We did a headline tour through the country of Sweden because we had a number one album with A Long Way to Heaven, which was the follow-up.
That's right, yeah.
A lot of times with bands back then, maybe not so much today, but you know, the record company would always release half the amount of units that you sold in the previous album. So because Walking the Razor's Edge was such a huge album, you know, they based what they were initially releasing on the final sales when they came out with that. So I think that helped push that album to be a big album. But probably the album that people knew us for in Sweden was were the first two, New Russell Wicked and Walking the Razor's Edge. And then we did some headline dates in the tour, but that whole period is kind of a blur when it comes to that.
Really? So so was it at the tail end of Walking on the Razor's Edge that you guys started headlining, and then you just, I know how it is with record companies, they just want you to get back into the studio, turn it around. Yeah. So that's a whole blur because it was just going at such a pace.
The headline tour I really remember in Canada was actually in Wild in the Streets because we had April Wine's old set, like the ramps and all that stuff, and we added to it. And
right.
We had the great big metal horns at the bottom, and so you could run up the ramp, so we had the show all choreographed where you could. But I thought one funny thing that happened with that stage is we were in, I think it was Regina or someplace, and you ever seen the Bugs Bunny show where Yosemite Sam's chasing Bugs Bunny on the boat, and they go up one level and in the door and then out the bottom door and stuff like that?
Right.
There was a guy jumped up on the stage and he ran up the one ramp with the horn, right? And Kenny, our road manager, was chasing. Well, he'd get up to one level and the guy'd be on the other level. And Kenny run up to that level and the guy run down the steps to the other level. Finally, Kenny tackled him, took him right off the back of the stage. And it was heavier than hell to cart around. I remember Fritz's drum stage was this huge aluminum thing. It was monster. And we played Trinidad in 1987, and our last date was actually at London Gardens here. And we had to go in the middle of a snowstorm up to Baden and take this thing to our manager's mother's barn to stick it in there. And the snow was about 6 feet deep, and it was snowing like hell. And here we are with this huge drums stage, and it was on a kind of a cart, right? And it took about 10 of us trying to carry this damn thing through the snow to get it into the barn. So I remember more stuff like that about the staging and the headline tour than anything else.
There's one thing that I got my memory jogged. Gimme Good Lovin' video is now very, very infamous because of one Tracy Lords appearing in the video.
Yeah.
And on YouTube, you can actually see the uncensored version that you guys did. You can see both.
Yes.
But you can actually see the uncensored version.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before she got, I guess, what do you call it, busted for being... Well, was she underage? She was
underage. We didn't do the casting for that video.
Nobody knew at the time.
Nobody knew at the time, and they haven't pulled that video. And you know, she was 15, and they pulled all her other stuff. Thing I remember about that video, it was shot at Francis Ford Coppola's old studio in Hollywood, Xanthrope. Is that how you say it? And Robin Williams and Richard Pryor and Rip Taylor were filming next door. They were doing Pryor's Place, and they came over, and I was a big Richard Pryor fan. I loved Richard Pryor. And when I met him, it was funny because he wasn't what I expected him to be. You know, he wanted to go, come on, Richard, say something funny. You know, but he was like, do you think somebody can get me a Helix album and get it signed? And he's talking really quiet. And we run out. We didn't have an album on us, so we run out to a record store, and we brought him back one and signed it for him. And Ron Williams was there, and he did a little skit for my Super 8 movie camera.
Really?
I still have that. And Rip Taylor was the same thing. Rip Taylor was actually the funniest of the three guys, if you want to know the truth.
And he's in the video.
He's
right?
in the video at the very end.
Is that
end,
because yeah. they were just next door? You just said, hey, Rip, when you come over?
Yeah, and they wanted us to go through all this paperwork and legal stuff to get him in, and we just thought it was too much, so we just put him in. We went, thought, well, if he sues, right?
But yeah.
That never, ever happened. He actually asked our manager, Bill, to come down and visit him, invite him to his house.
What are you going to do with all this footage, the Super 8 footage of Robin Williams and...
Oh,
and
I got so much stuff in
first
film.
First Gold record and Rush and all this stuff, man.
I got stuff downstairs. I got even just the last 15 years, I have the little mini discs, mm-hmm. you know, that you put in a Sony camera. I have something like 160 of those. You know, I got the whole Trailer Park Boys tour... when we were out in Western Canada.
And I just saw Bubbles.
Yeah, you just saw Mike.
We played Halifax last week.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mike came out.
He's a great guy. They're all great guys. They're so down to earth.
Yeah.
I feel honored that they consider me their friend.
He is a great dude and very approachable, very cool. Just a regular, yeah. really cool guy.
And, well, our connection with those guys started back when they had the one episode where they had Rush in it, Closer to the Heart,
right.
the name of the episode was. And Archie Gamble, who was in the band playing drums for me at the time, he emailed them, and Mike Clattenburg got a hold of me, and we became friends through email. And I said to Mike, I said, look at Mike, I said, if I come out there on my own dime and I pay for my own hotel room and everything else, would it be all right if I came down and watched you film an episode? I said, because I've never seen a TV show being filmed, and I'd love to see that happen. He's so sure. So I flew out, and they picked me at the airport, and they took me, and I couldn't believe how well I was treated by the guys. They treated me like I was the star, right? And meanwhile, I'm just in awe of those guys. And the funny thing was, when we went to leave, they gave me a limo ride back to the airport, and for some reason, I decided to stick my camera in my luggage bag before I went through security. And here they put a 14-inch tinfoil penis in my luggage, and
they did,
hoping to set off all the alarms. Meanwhile, there was a few smiles from the girls working security at the airport when I pulled that out. But then I did a tour with Trailer Park Boys and Swollen Members through Western Canada. A couple years after that, and
with
then
Helix, Swollen Members, and Trailer Park Boys.
That's correct, all through Western Canada, and I got tons of. I filmed almost every night, and I got some really funny stuff. Then I had like a 3-second part in the second movie, Countdown to Liquor Day.
Right. Yeah.
And Alex Lifeson was in that at the end, and that's a whole other story. I don't think I could tell here.
I can imagine. Did you see, was Mike Smith on the tour of the Guns N' Roses tour in London when we first met, you and I first met? Was Mike Smith on that tour?
I don't think he was there that night. And I'll tell you something, I think that connection with Guns N' Roses is because of Sebastian.
That's what I figured.
And I feel I got Sebastian on that show because we did Sweden Rock, and I think, can't remember when the date was now, but I rode all the way back in the bus in the same seat with Sebastian from Malmo back to Copenhagen. And Baz said to me at that time, he said, I want to be on that show. Get me on that show. And I went, well, I said, I'll do my best. So I contacted Mike Clattenburg. I said, look, Sebastian Bach wants to be on in the show, right? And I never heard anything back. I don't think Mike Clattenburg knew who Sebastian was. And then I think somewhere along the line, it clicked in who he was, and then they saw the show and he was on, right?
Right.
And then, you know, because Baz knew Axl, I think he introduced Mike to Axl, and that's how Mike ended up going out with Guns N' Roses.
Well, because I know Axl is, like, the number one fan of that show.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
Since that, I guess, I don't know when the introduction was made. Maybe it was through Baz, but Axl and Mike are really good friends.
Yeah.
And that's how... We actually played with Mike's old band, Sandbox,
yes,
years ago at Fort Erie. And Mike remembered it, and then we had a kind of a reunion on the tour. And, yeah, Axl would bring him out for the encore or something for as Bubbles. And then we hung out a few nights. But the Halifax show, as far as I remember, Bubbles told Axl that none of the cast can make it. You know, something was, I don't know, he made up some excuse. And then the whole cast, the three, Ricky and Julian,
yeah,
showed up. And what's the dude's, the crazy old man, drunken?
Oh, Jim Leahy.
Yeah, Leahy.
John Dunford.
Leahy, Julian and Ricky showed up with Bubbles on stage and surprised Axl, and it was the last show of the tour, and it was crazy. But what was even crazier was we were backstage, and Ricky and Julian, I don't know if they were in character or whatever, they were hanging out backstage in our dressing room, and they were dressed as who they were. Julian had his glass. And I never met these guys before. I just knew Bubbles. I just knew Mike. But I never met Julian. He had the glass. And I'm like going, is he the dude all the time? Is this how it is all the time?
They are kind of like that. Yep.
It was crazy. It was an amazing night. But yeah, that kind of freaked me out too, because I didn't really know. And Leahy, I guess he was getting into character, so he was like, we were backstage. There was no audience. We were their audience, but we were part of the show, and they were all in character. And I couldn't fucking figure out what the fuck was going on.
Well, you know, when I first met them and went to see them film, I think the name of the episode I saw was "I Think You Pissed Yourself, Mr. Leahy." The first time Conky was ever in one of the episodes, and we filmed all day long, like 16 hours, and then we went out to some place to get a bite to eat, and we were sitting on a patio, and there's all sorts of people coming up asking for autographs, and they're being polite and they're signing everything. But the thing I found so amazing was, if you watch the first couple seasons, Ricky's always wearing that black and white checkered shirt, and it's got the big rip.
Yeah.
He was wearing that shirt.
Yeah.
We were like an Edie, right? But even on tour when we were out west, you know, whereas, and you know this from being on tour, you always go to the headline and knock on the door, gets over if I come in.
Yeah.
Not there. It's like wide open door policy. Everybody just, there's all sorts of people walking in and out, and, you know, people smoking these great big gaggers and stuff, and it was pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
But, you know, Mike can rub shoulders with somebody like Axl Rose, some of the biggest stars in the world, and then, you know, somebody will come up off the street and he'll have the same demeanor with that person. I think that's such a class act when people do that. I remember I flew back from Ottawa one time and to London, and people were laughing on the plane. I go, what's so funny? And they went, "Is that guy over there? Looks like Maurice Richard." So anyway, I got off the plane, I'm walking, I see this guy walk beside me. I said, "Hey, you're not Maurice Richard, right?" And he goes, "Yes, I am." I went, "Holy shit," right? So I run out to my van, and I had a little pad and paper, you know, a pen, and I see him get ushered out, and he's got a minder, and he gets in this van, and I'm standing there like a tool with this, you know, little scribbler and a pen, and the van comes whipping by me. It goes to the end of the row in the parking lot, and all of a sudden the brake lights come on, and he made that driver back up, all the way back up to where I was, and he got out and signed my autograph. And I thought, this guy's a class act. And Mike Smith is the same thing. All those guys are. I think that adds to your longevity as a performer too, when you're like that. In fact, you know, we were talking about Lemmy before. He's comes from the cut from the same cloth, right? He sits there at the Rainbow, and I've never ever heard him not talking to someone. And I know from being on tour, he was very accessible too.
Yeah, he is very accessible and very friendly. He's been very nice to our band over the years. Yeah. All those two guys, especially that you mentioned, I've seen it. I've seen people come up to Mike, even in Halifax. The fight was on, the Pacquiao Mayweather fight, when we were in Halifax. So I announced it on stage. I said something like Pacquiao over Mayweather or something like that. So Mike came backstage and he's like, you guys watching the fight? Like, we should go watch the fight. And people coming up to him, like you said, exactly, very approachable and just shot the shit with everybody. And that was it. And that is very impressive, especially for someone as huge as his character is, and now in pop culture.
Not just in Canada anymore. No. Like, same thing in the States, over in England. Yeah. A lot of places, Australia, I think they're big there down there now.
Well, they're about to do a European tour, he was saying. And a European tour, I mean, this is you know, different cultures, different... with music, you and I, we can tour Europe. Music is, can, you know...
the universal language.
Yeah, it goes beyond a language, but these are comedians and actors, and they're doing, you know, they're speaking.
Doesn't necessarily always translate well.
No, and he said that like the rooms are sold out. They had to move them to bigger rooms. So Trailer Park Boys is a show that I was a little late on, I must admit. And guys in our band, in our entourage, our crew, they kept telling me, you would love this show. And I'm so slow with shows. I was like...
I'm the same way, right?
Yeah. It takes me years to get into Breaking Bad. I finally got in the last season. But they would... So they said, sit down. We're going to show you... They tailor-made one. Like, watch this episode. It was the Alex Lyson one. And then there was another one where they turned one of the trailers into a nightclub, and then it was a gay club or something by mistake or something. And so they tailor-made these shows, and they won me over. So every night on whatever tour it was, we'd finish the show, and we'd watch a couple of episodes of Trailer Park Boys, and then we'd all go to hit our bunks or whatever. So that was like a routine. So when we finally met them on the Guns N' Roses tour, I mean, to me, they were just like, they were rocks. They were bigger than Axl Rose. It was watching like they were the headliners for as far as I was concerned. So it was pretty cool. Yeah, there has been some great hangs. But when I met you in London at the arena here in London for the Guns N' Roses tour.
Yes.
Was you I thought that was your connection in. Obviously this is your hometown, but was it through Baz as well? Like just getting in?
It was through Baz.
Yeah, hanging out. That's what I figured, because when we were out in Calgary, Greg Godovitz, I think, got through backstage because of Baz, you know.
That's because Baz and Greg were responsible for the closing down of the Gasworks party.
Oh, right.
And that's where I first met Sebastian. And then we reconnected over in Sweden Rock. And I put in a word for him for the show, whether or not that's what got him on or not, I don't know. But and then I just kept in touch with him through email.
He's another great guy. Meeting him, knowing that we were doing the Guns tour and Baz was going to be on the tour, and we're from the same neighborhood in Willowdale. Took me about a week and a half to ask him about it, but the first minute I met him, he was like, he yelled out my name and he was really welcoming and gracious, and that really put me at ease. You know, and it was, I've always wanted to meet him, and the way I met him was the best way possible. And I just know that Baz has only respect for, you know, other guys and other Canadian bands.
Well,
and
when we were over in Sweden Rock, I'll never forget this. We were backstage after Baz's show, and Baz is up in this crate, just like an orange crate or, you know, pop case or something, right? And there was like, he was being mobbed. There was like 200-300 people, and he was standing up. And I'm kind of on the peripheral edge of this crowd. And he happened to see me over there, and all of a sudden he stops what he was doing, talking to the crowd. He goes, hey, everybody, over there, that guy, he sings for Helix, one of the greatest bands in the world. He's going like this. And I felt kind of like embarrassed, you know what I mean? Because, you know what I mean? Like, coming from Baz, that was a real compliment. And, yeah.
But now, last week we played London, your hometown, London, Ontario. And before the show...
Great show.
Thank you. It was very... There was pressure, knowing you were in the crowd. Pressure.
really?
Yeah. Freaked me out a bit. But I went onward, finished the show.
I enjoyed it so much, I almost stayed right to the end. And I was with a guy that had to get up at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah, so. You're saying, yeah. No problem, I understand. But before the show, you came backstage and we were talking. And I said, well, Brian, I got to warm up. You know, I just got to do my own ritual thing of warming my voice up. And then you dropped this whole bel canto bomb on me.
Yeah.
So I had no idea that you are a teacher of, what is it, a singing technique, a style?
Bel canto means, or bel voce means beautiful voice in Italian. And bel canto was... came about in the 1600s, and it's a vocal technique that everybody used to use back then. Very little was written down about it over the years, and the person that taught me, Edward Johnson, was actually one of the few people that actually went and researched it and found out if it was even scientifically, physically possible, and it was. And he developed a technique to teach bel canto. He taught Ian Thomas, Beverly D'Angelo, Gilmore of Triumph, Andy Kern, Coney Hatch, and just literally thousands of people. And then he taught a few select people to be teachers, and I was the only one he really put his blessing on, mainly because I was the only one that went back week after week, year after year, for 15 years. I'd travel all the way up to Fergus, Ontario. It took me 2.5 hours to drive up there. And then I take my lesson 2.5 hours back. So basically, my day was a write-off once I did that. But I'd go up with a list of questions to ask them about my students. And now I teach, and I've been teaching now since 1988, I think.
Holy smokes. What made you go 2.5 hours there and back every week? What was it that was driving you to do it? Obviously, for professional reasons, but wasn't there a point where you're like, okay, I got this?
Well, initially, I went to take vocal lessons, when to save my voice. In 1976, I had nodes in my vocal cords, and I was told I would never, ever sing again. And my manager at that time, William Sipe, sent me to Ed, and Ed took me aside, I'll never forget this, put his arm around my shoulder and said, look, kid, just do what I tell you to do and your nodes will go away, and as long as you're patient. And sure enough, in 1 year, I didn't take any time off from the road. I didn't get them operated on or anything like that. My nodes went away. And it took me a long time, though, for my voice to repair itself fully. But now I'm 60 years old, and I think I'm singing better than when I was 18 years old. Around 1988, after my first divorce, I was basically penniless on the streets. I had gold and platinum albums on the wall, but nothing in my pocket. And I worked part-time jobs. I worked through Manpower and these terrible, shitty jobs that no one else would take for a couple of years. And I thought, I can't do this. All I need to do is get sick for 2 weeks and I'm sunk. And I couldn't go back to school. I felt I was too old, and nobody'd hire me for a decent paying job. So I thought, well, the only thing I know how to do half-assed well is to sing. So I phoned up Ed and I said, Ed, what would you think of me becoming a teacher? And he said, oh yeah, I used to teach, be a teacher. You come here and I'll teach you. So that's how it began. And I really treasured those moments with Ed. We'd go down there and he not only would advise me in the technique and what to look for, because remember, when you teach voice, it's an invisible instrument. It's not like learning how to teach guitar or keyboards or drums where you can watch your hands or your feet. Your voice is invisible. And not only that, but your body is your instrument when you're singing. Unlike a guitar, if you break a string, you go get a new string. Once you screw up your voice, that's pretty well it. So... he taught me to be a teacher, and I started off with a couple students, and now I'm up to, I don't know, what have I got there, about 30 students or something.
That's a list of all your students.
Yeah, and it goes up and down during the week, and or up, you know, from week to week, rather.
Who are your students? Who are these people?
Well, I've taught Morgan and Mercedes Lander from Kitty, Tim Hicks, who's had quite a few country hits.
So singers, like real, like...
Yeah. Professional singers,
professional.
Weekend singers, sometimes just, you know, people that want to do it for a laugh. They've always wanted to try it. But, you know, it's mostly professional singers this is for, because it takes a long time to learn how to do it. The only way you learn how to do it is through repetition, going over and over and over and over and over. The technique and... there's basically four steps: how to lift your throat, how to aim your voice, how to inhale your voice, and then the hold of the breath. And you learn it all to exercises, which are essentially vowels with consonants tacked at either ends, which are like words, only unlike words, they have no emotional content in the exercises. So you learn how to lift your throat and aim your voice and the other things with the exercises. And then once you learn how to master that, then the next logical step is to apply it to words and syllables of songs.
And this is for preservation of voice.
For preservation of voice, and also to increase your, I shouldn't say increase your range, because you're born with your range, but... most people don't know how to use their full range. So how to control your voice, how to breathe correctly, and basically make your voice last. Your voice shouldn't peak until you're 65 years old. Most people in rock, though, they're burning out by the time they get 55.
Yeah.
And ironically, this is where you make the most money. Not at the other end, this end.
Now, you said you had notes, and I think I remember you telling me backstage last week, you should never go under the knife for notes.
No, because usually when you get them operated on it, your vocal cords lose their flexibility, and it's at some point as bad as having the note itself. A note is really just a callus on your vocal cord. It's your body's way of protecting your vocal cord from the bad things you're doing it to your vocal cords. In other words, singing incorrectly.
And I can imagine... you know, like you said you were 18, an 18 version of Brian Vollmer didn't warm up, just was ready for the stage and never really thought about and sung from your throat.
I actually warmed up. It was just I was such a hard singer, and like most rock singers, I was a belter, or try to throw my voice, push my voice. And whenever you push your voice, when you see singers and they're singing, they have all that muscular tension down around their Adam's apple or thyroid cartilage. All that tension is transferred to the vocal cords. There's almost no way around it when you sing like that.
And and you don't do that.
I try not to anymore.
Right.
You're not going to do it 100% perfect when you're singing rock, because rock is a distorted sound, as is pop, country. In classical music, they always sing pure vowel sounds, no distortion. In fact, any distortion in classical music is considered a big no-no.
Right.
But you can learn how to sing that you're not losing your voice all the time.
Because you don't go through the bel canto technique to clean your voice out. Obviously, anyone who hears you, you are a very rock and roll singer.
That's right.
That distortion. So. The bel canto technique didn't wipe away the rock and roll from your voice.
No, it didn't change the sound of my voice. It just allowed me to do it night after night. Also, to increase my range, control, better tone.
Right. And now, Helix is how many albums deep?
This is the 41st year for the band, and I don't know how many albums we got. Let's go through them. Breaking Loose, White Lace and Black Leather, No Rest for the Wicked, Walking to Razor's Edge, Long Way to Heaven, Wild in the Streets, Back for Another Taste, It's a Business Doing Pleasure, and of course there's all the compilation albums in there, Rockin' in My Outer Space, The Power of Rock and Roll, Vagabond Bones, Heavy Mental Christmas, Bastard of the Blues, and the Smash Hits Unplugged.
Is that 14? albums, I think.
And then there's B-sides, which is unreleased tracks. And right. 60 Minutes With, Deep Cuts. Yeah, there you go, eh?
This is great. This is something I've wanted to do for a long time. Schedules, however, don't permit. As you know, being on the road,
yes,
the last thing you want to do sometimes when you're off the road is move. And there's only a few things that would get me to move, and a chance to sit down with you.
Thank you very much for coming down.
It's a wonderful...
It's an honor to have be interviewed by you, to tell you the truth.
Oh, the honor is mine, Brian, and thank you for having me here at Planet Helix.
Now I got to take you for a tour.
Okay, let's do it. I'm interested. I could see all the platinum records, just in case anybody wants to know. There's a lot of platinum records here, and I want to know what else is there. And lots of really cool, neat stuff.
I'll show you my Wall of Shame and stuff. You're going to have to sign my Wall of Shame downstairs.
You got to sign my album, too.
Okay, I will. Okay.
Thanks, Brian.
And you're welcome.